that it's so important, honestly, is the following. So I'm a Virgo. I'm 49 years old, married with two little ones. I wanted to be a philosopher my whole life. I grew up in a Jewish... My father is a conservative rabbi, a Jewish rabbi. I grew up in an observant home, and I'm going to say something about that in a minute. And I always wanted to be a philosopher. My mother was a philosopher. And so I pursued both religion and philosophy. I went to Princeton undergrad, and then I spent 2 years living in Southeast Asia, and then in Indonesia. I speak Indonesian and traveled there extensively, and then made my way to Harvard. I did a master's in theological studies at Harvard. I studied Christian theology and Jewish theology, and then I went to Stanford for my PhD. I was there for 11 years, and I had started to teach San Jose State and Cal State Hayward when I was finishing my dissertation, and I decided against finishing my dissertation, I decided to become a pastor. Decided instead to just become a rabbi, and that's maybe not a topic for today. Gigi and probably knows more about that from private conversations, but I devoted my... But it's relevant here based on the kinds of things you're going to be doing. When I was at Harvard in the Divinity School, I remember the president of Harvard said, "We're in this ridiculous situation. Everyone wants to give money to the business school and the law school and the med school, and yet I can't even pay for like janitorial services for the nursing school, School of Public Health, the so there was the nursing school, the ed school, and the Divinity School." And he's like, "And yet those are the schools that are actually fulfilling our mission. Those are the schools that are going out and helping people, which is supposed to be the mission of a university." And I think that, you know, 12 years later, I came to the same conclusion. So I started to feel that, to go out and help people and to help people in their practical lives, going through marriage, divorce, birth, death, illness, and just in general growth is a valuable thing to do. And while I miss teaching, though, so like I really, really do. And so I praise you for what you're going out to do, whatever it is, whether it's teaching or social work. As you know, in our society, work that is inherently meaningful is usually low paid. And so I wish you only winning the lottery and doing good work in this world. So I think it's a brilliant idea, and I'm so grateful to Professor Anderson for inviting me in to think about a sensitivity to different religions and different kinds of peoples. What do they hear when you're interacting with them? Because something that you think could be a huge compliment could be, you know, like, "Some of my best friends are Jewish." You know, they may take it like, "I don't know how I feel about you saying that. You know, I knew a Jew once." So, and this can be for any ethnic group or religion. So how I've tried to guide my talk, and I definitely try to leave... Gigi, hold me to it. Professor Anderson, don't be too polite. So make sure I leave time for questions and interaction. I'm going to try to tell you some of those things, and that may get us into uncomfortable terrain. So it may get us into a place where you're like, "I'm not sure I really like what that guy just said." And so I don't mind. It's not about coming to the truth. It's about, I'm glad to get an opportunity to present a little bit some of the uncomfortable areas, even how a Jew might hear words that that are coming out of someone's mouth who isn't Jewish or even who is Jewish. And so sometimes that's unexpected. So, and we're going to cover a lot. And a lot of what we're going to do, I think, is stuff that even most Jews probably don't know. So some of it will be me telling you sort of historically what's true or what the tradition thinks of as true. And I'm also going to try to tell you what just your average Jew on the street might think, because that could be something very, very different. So I'm going to start off with some of the biggies. And some of them you may know, and some of you may not. But if I ever make it, I gave a talk at Grossmont College in the philosophy department 2 years ago, and it was like their big spring annual lecture or something. And I definitely know I made some people uncomfortable. It was on my dissertation research in religion and science. So like I said, I'm used to, if I see someone squirming, I'll slow down and backtrack as fast as I can. Here we go. So some of the ways, so one of the big questions that we have in Judaism is it a religion or is it a people? Or in contemporary parlance, ethnicity. Is it a people, is it an ethnicity, or is it a religion? So first, let's talk a little bit about what we think religion is in Judaism. We have one line of creed. We only have one dogma. So in my synagogue, we have a 2.5-hour Saturday morning service. Most services are only 15 minutes, but Jews don't come to those. They just try to... the service they don't go to is the long one. So, and they don't come to the other ones either. So, but in that long service, we say it three times, but there's only one line of creed, and that is God is one. It's actually about seven words in Hebrew, but it's just God is one. What you think that means is up to you. It can mean just about anything. And that's up to you. What your personal relationship with God is, your personal understanding of God is considered to be private. Right? So, and this can be very different. I mean, there's sometimes it's going to be an obvious contrast, maybe with other religions, but I'm not trying to stereotype other religions. But I'm saying, it may be very normal to have a college roommate who says to you, well, these are my beliefs. Like, what's God to you? And what do you think about God? What are you praying to? Or why don't you pray to this or that or the other? For, you know, someone once asked me, what are you doing when you pray? What are you doing when you connect to God? And I said, that's a little bit like asking me, what do I do with my wife in the bedroom? So this is the first cultural thing I want to tell you, which is, it's very private. I have a direct relationship with, every human being has a direct relationship with God, according to Judaism. There's no intermediary. But that partly means it's kind of intimate. It's kind of private. It also kind of means that you don't have to talk about it. Like, just like I don't have to talk about my marriage necessarily. I could if I want to. So if Gigi says, you know, because I know her, we're friends, you know, she says, you know, Rabbi, I've been thinking lately when I do yoga, I feel like I'm connecting to God. Do you ever feel like you're connecting to God in that kind of way? I may say, I'd love to talk about this. But I also have a right to be like, it's just not polite conversation always to say, what's your personal relationship with God? Do you have a relationship with God and what is it? So I might want to talk about it. But I might say it's not something we always do. We always talk about. One of the reasons is this. Maybe I don't know. You can say God is one and not be sure what that means. In the Jewish religion, the notion is that we're all growing. One of my greatest challenges as a religious leader is working with children. Right? For the most part in America, people only receive a religious education in Sunday school. For the people I'm going to call the rabbis. The rabbis refers to the group of leaders who existed for about, well, they still really continue to exist. When the Jewish country fell in 70 AD, I'll do a little history really quick. So at least you know who the rabbis are because I'm going to keep mentioning them. Judaism started as a shepherd religion in approximately 1600 BC. And we have these people, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Moses, they're all shepherds, King David, shepherd. We were a shepherd religion, we were nomads, and we traveled between the area of Egypt and Babylonia, and we had shepherd spirituality. It was that no one owns the earth but God, because we go where our flocks go. You don't actually have a fixed set of land, because your goats eat it pretty quickly. Hospitality is incredibly important. Your tent is open to everybody. And material possessions are relatively unimportant because the more you have is just the more you have to carry. And you're constantly moving. You're constantly camping. In fact, well, forget it. I'll get too obscure on that. So we started as shepherd religion. And our basic values come out of that. In fact, the Book of Psalms, which is the basis for much of Jewish prayer and has been for thousands of years, largely shepherd poetry. For those who may be Christian or Muslim or who like reading the Book of Psalms in Scripture, you'll notice over and over again, it's like God is our shepherd and we are like the flock and it's like being... So, and it's very highly personal and meditative. Originally, Judaism stood as a kind of contrast to agricultural religion, which existed in Egypt and Babylonia. So very different spirituality. The spirituality of scraping out your life in the earth, worrying about rain and growing things and the anxiety, the horlishah, who owns the land, who doesn't own the land, is the sky god going to fertilize, you know, bring God's sperm to Mother Earth so I can actually scrape out a living and congregating in areas where there's water or there's no water versus our religion, which is we were kind of the hillbillies who lived in the desert and lived in tents and everyone, you know, sort of thought we were pretty pathetic. The spirituality of basically sitting all day watching your goats munch on weeds. That's where the Psalms come from. It's kind of like you bring out your guitar, your lyre, your flute, and you sit there and you move your goats from place to place. And that's really the origin of a lot of Jewish prayer and spirituality, of peace, connecting directly with nature, connecting to God through nature, witnessing flocks and keeping the herds together, etc., etc. So we were initially a shepherd spirituality. We got our own country in about roughly 1000 BC. Really about 1020 is when the Israelite country began under King Saul. In the Bible, which largely follows history, and archaeologically this is verified, so I'll just say historically speaking, about 1000 BC is King David, second king of Israel, and Israel is formed in the area that's largely today Israel. The country lasts for 1,000 years, although it's periodically destroyed and restarted, reinaugurated. And that has a lot to do with the concept of Messiah, which may come up later. If you want to ask me, like, what's the Jewish concept of Messiah? It has a lot to do with that 1,000-year history. But after 1,000 years, it was finally destroyed once and for all by the Romans. And the Romans killed hundreds of thousands of Jews and massacred them, destroyed the temple in Jerusalem, and removed the king. And that the finality of that is in 70 AD. Then we weren't a country anymore. Question was, I guess that's it for us. I mean, you don't have a country. I mean, if Babylonia is destroyed, there's no more Babylonia, you know. A group of leaders stepped forward who really hadn't existed before. Sometimes they're referred to as the Pharisees in New Testament studies. We generally call them, because Pharisees is a very specific word that refers to only one sect of them, but we traditionally just call them the rabbis. Some people call them the sages. They were the initial people who had a new idea for our religion. I would forget. It wasn't a religion. We were a country. And they said, we'll create a religion out of the country. We'll create a portable Israelite. You can now be an Israelite without an Israel. So I would say, if you're an American and Canada invades us and takes us over, and now we're just Canada. And then some people are like, we're not giving up on America. We're going to be Americans. And they said, how could we make portable Americanism and take it, and so that we could move to Sweden and be Americans? We don't have to be Swedish over there. And we wrote a little book. We would write first section, and we'd be like, well, okay, holidays. We've got to keep July 4th. And what do you do on July 4th? We've got a barbecue, and we got to do Thanksgiving with turkey and eggnog. And you'd start writing down holidays. And then you'd say other things like, well, you know, we're not going to do Swedish weddings. Like, or, you know, we're going to do, how's it go again? And the, like, dearly beloved, we're gathered here. Let's write that out. So things like that can be portable, like holidays and weddings and even the way we get divorced. Are we going to get divorced? Oh, well, we have our own way of getting divorced. We'll do it this way. And all that stuff they wrote down in a book. And it was a very short book. You don't know what it's called. It's called the Mishnah. And they said, we'll now go out and we can have communities where we can still be Israelite without a country, and that is what we call Judaism. So they created portable, and that's what has survived. So we call the rabbis those people. They were not actually at all like me. I mean, in the sense they weren't really pastors, and they did not lead worship. They actually were much more. They had schools. They were basically more like they modeled themselves on the Greek schools, like Aristotle had a school, Socrates had a school, Euripides, you know, And so Epicurus had a school. They opened up academies to train people. They're basically school principals. And they also served as civil judges for people to adjudicate disputes. They were like Judge Judy and Judge Wapner and these people. That's basically the way they made their money, and is they adjudicated disputes between people. So there's a much longer story about that. So this is who the rabbis are. So I'm going to go back to your relationship with God. As I said, the rabbis basically said, they wrote something called the Talmud, which they added to the Mishnah, and they wrote this stuff. What's it mean to be a Jew? What does it mean to do this? And they say that you're going to grow all through your life, and your idea of what God is going to change. And so you want to keep this kind of openness to the one line of creed, God is one. That could completely change throughout your life. So that's kind of a hard thing to talk about. The idea that I'm like, well, Gigi, what's your God? And Gigi's like, well, Nadav, what's your God? Kind of implies it's static, like it never changes. The picture I got in Sunday school is the same picture I have today. So they're very careful about, like, don't talk about God too much. Like, if you talk about God too much, you're probably going to say stupid things. That's really what they said. And in fact, one of our, you know, they also canonized. They decided on which books deserve to be called Holy Scripture. And two of the books the rabbis put in were actually the book of Esther, the story of Esther, and we have a holiday called Purim about it. And they put in a book of sexual poetry, erotic poetry, called the Song of Solomon or the Song of Songs, neither of which mention God. And what they wrote in the Talmud is this: God is mostly present where God is not mentioned. And it's something I take to heart. I think we all get, you know, every time I see the football, if anybody's a football player, forgive me. Okay. But for me as a Jew, when I see the football player spike, you know, God got the touchdown, it's a very weird thing for us, because I'm kind of like, I think that's like the least place where God was getting that touchdown. And then when someone tells me something like, and I get this all the time, Rabbi, I don't believe in God. I don't believe in worship services. I mean, all this stuff. And I'm not religious in any way. I think it's all silly. And then they tell me some story of how their best friend got them through cancer, got them through chemo. I'm sitting there thinking, as a rabbi, that's where God is. God's there with your friend getting you through chemo. And if I could even teach you the healing prayers that we do and the rituals around healing and the rituals of visiting the sick, that's what it's about. I mean, the Talmud says God is most present when someone is visiting a sick person to give them company and build up their morale. But this person doesn't know that because they just went to Sunday school and learned Noah and the Ark and the flood and are convinced that none of that really happened. And they're like, I know better than the rabbi. But that's really nice, Rabbi, that you think like a five-year-old. But for me, I don't believe in God, but this is my holy thing. And I'm thinking, that's what our tradition says. God is actually most present. And think about a book of sexual and erotic poetry. So I'm a very happily married man. That's definitely true. You know, like, I mean, like, God is most present. But yeah, I mean, you know, in bed we don't say, God did that. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, but God did that. God brings two souls together to celebrate one another, which is the prayer we use at the wedding. That's the seventh of the seven blessings. That blessed be God whose presence brings bride and groom together in a special, unique delight in one another. So the God stuff. So I'm telling you, God is one. It's the only thing we say. We don't have any other theology. So it's a religion of practice over a religion of belief. What you believe is highly personal, largely up to you, free thinking, very much encouraged. And yet, even Jews for thousands of years have said, they don't use the word religious, I mean, they do today. If someone said, are you religious, what they mean in Jewish terms is, are you observant? We use the word observant. And observant means of keeping certain practices, not observant of beliefs. Traditionally, observance meant you kept Sabbath laws. The laws on Friday night to Saturday at sundown, you kept certain restrictions. It meant you kept certain food restrictions, like not eating pork or shrimp. These days, people can't stay away from the shrimp, so I guess it's mostly just trying not to eat pork. But there's certain dietary laws that you would keep, not mixing meat and milk at the same time when you're eating. And so it would be Sabbath laws on Saturday, certain food laws, some of the food laws, and holidays. That you would keep a holiday. On Friday night, you'd go to a Passover Seder this coming Friday night. By the way, when I told you that the rabbis made the religion very portable, Judaism's very, observance is very home-based. So what they did was they said, wait a second. If you actually read the book of Exodus, the second book of the Hebrew Bible, you'll say, wait a second. What's the Seder thing? Passover is when you take your animal to get sacrificed in the temple and let its meat be shared with the poor and the workers of the temple and others publicly. And that's what you take a sacrifice to the temple so that you can basically feed the poor. And the rabbi's like, well, we don't have any temple because you could be in Sweden and you can be, literally, you could be in Istanbul. You could be in Cairo. You could be in Poland. You could be in Canada. You could be anywhere, Netherlands. So their attitude is, ain't no going to be any sacrifice. So they made holidays be home-based. And I think it's great. So Judaism really ended up with Passover. You don't have to go to synagogue for Passover, except for Gigi's family. You guys have to go. I'm waiting to see you. Okay, because otherwise I'll be all alone. But the truth is you only have to. You have a Seder at home for Passover and other holidays. Hanukkah, you stay at home. even the Sabbath, every Friday night, you stay at home, you light two candles, you bless your kids, you have a fantastic dinner, and you drink a lot of wine, and don't drive. So, and for the rabbis, if you're married, you put the beds, the kids, you drink a lot of wine, go to bed early, and you stay up late with your spouse in bed. So, like, my wife told me, I don't know why, but she told me to make sure I tell you the Jewish view of sin and the body, and so hopefully I'll get to that. And so you can see it's very home-based. So religious means observant, and most of these things you don't have to go to a synagogue for. They're mostly just home things like keeping holidays, and if you want to keep some of the dietary laws, I don't eat the bacon, please don't put pepperoni on my slice of the pizza, and some kind of observance for the Sabbath. So nothing about belief in God. So one of the questions comes up, can you believe in God and be a good Jew? Absolutely. In fact, you can push that very, very, very far. I've known ultra-fundamentalists in Israel. I mean, the whole garb and the thing, and they look like they stepped out of a village in Poland in 1830. And sometimes I'll talk to their teenage kids who are completely growing up in it. And I'll say something like, so how much do you guys talk about God in this community? I mean, they're like Amish. I mean, they're like, they don't go to public school, they don't go to college, anything like that. They keep separate. And, you know, so I've been in some of those communities and lived in some of them. And, you know, they'll take in a guest like the Amish will. You can live with them. And they'll be like, the God thing doesn't come up much. And I'm like, well, I'll say something like, well, do you believe in God? I mean, I know we're not supposed to ask people this, but like, kind of do you? You know, you get to know someone, you can ask them. And they're like, I don't know. Probably not. And then, now, when I was at Stanford, one of the reasons I quit academia was I was writing a dissertation about how this is possible, and most of my non-Jewish professors just couldn't believe it. They're like, it's not rational. Why would you keep the restrictions of Saturday? For example, you wouldn't do your homework on Saturday, and you won't go to work on Saturday, and you won't drive on Saturday, and you won't cook on Saturday. Why would you do any of those if you actually don't believe there's a God up in the sky who commanded you not to do those things? To which the answer is pretty simple. It's awesome. It is awesome to have a day off where your employer can't like email you and be like, can you just do one more thing for me? You know what I mean? And your friends who want to hang out with you, you're like, no, I'm just going to stay home with my dog. Like, it's awesome, right? So for these people, they're like, it doesn't matter whether you believe in God. It's a set of practices. This is a completely normal thing in our religion. And yet, you know, professors at Stanford are like, that can't be true. Go rewrite this. You know, and I'm like, okay. But my doctoral advisor was Jewish, and he's like, of course it's true. That's the way we work. So I wanted to set sensitivity about usually defined by outward observance. Now let me take that to a whole other place, which is, how are you, if there is judgment, if there is cosmic divine judgment upon you, if it's not just that you can be anything you want to be, you can be an evil and terrible person and there are no consequences in the universe because God doesn't exist. I mean, there's some sense that some kind of God, whatever you think that means, exists. That being good is better than being bad or being evil. Then how does that force judge? What is judgment? And the answer is judgment is only about your actions, not about your beliefs. So, for example, if you want to put this in really simplistic religious imagery, who goes to heaven in Judaism? Everybody goes to heaven in Judaism. According to the Talmud, according to our tradition, everyone goes to heaven who is a decently acting human being. Whether you ever heard of Judaism, whether you speak Hebrew, whether you believed in many gods or one God, irrelevant. Irrelevant. All decently behaving human beings go to heaven. How about people who were not decently behaving? They have a delay. Catholics call this purgatory, but we have it too. There's a delay until some part of your soul is purified. It's not hellfire at all, but there's some sense in which eventually there's some delay before your soul like readjusts, but then you go home to God, whatever that means. So that's what I mean. Like, cosmic judgment is based upon actions, not based upon beliefs. Okay. So the religion defines itself as practice, not belief, and we went over through some of those things. I wanted to mention something about some of the people you'll be dealing with in your lives, which is they're Americans living in the 21st century. They don't know about the Talmud. They didn't study with me. Maybe they went to Sunday school for a little while, and trust me, there's only so much you can teach an 8-year-old. I mean, you guys can do it better than I can. I mean, I get down on my hands and knees and I do my best, but what I mean is, like, there, a certain amount of abstract thinking is not there. We have a very abstract intellectual religion, so we focus on being a good person and things like that. But they don't have the best knowledge of their religion. Many American Jews don't define being religious that way anymore. The idea that you do holidays, you have some kind of Sabbath practice, you be a good person, that makes you religious. They define it in what a sociologist would call a classic 20th century American Protestant model. You are religious if you believe in a supreme being, you believe in God, and you go to church. So even many people you'll be dealing with, they say, Rabbi. So I say, Rabbi, I'm not religious. I don't believe in that big God in the sky. I'm glad you do. That's sweet. Good for you. You know. And the other reason I'm not religious is I don't go to synagogue. I don't go to worship services. Now, historically, this is not the way Judaism, a Jew has defined themselves as religious. We've adopted that model from kind of the classic Protestant American model in America, which is 6 days a week you work, Sunday. Where I grew up in Philadelphia, everything was closed on Sunday. We have blue laws. So, like, Sunday, everything shuts down. People go to church. You get a sermon about being ethical and moral in this world. And Jews modeled themselves on this. Immigrant Jews loved that model. And they adopted, so they hired people like me. The rabbi is not a teacher anymore. And the rabbi is not a wise person I look to for spiritual guidance. The rabbi stands up. He leads a service. He says, page 23, let's sing hymn 26. And I'm stuck with that role. And it's hard for me because it's not what my tradition says my role is supposed to be. But it got defined that way in America. So I just want to point out that I'm saying what the tradition said. But today, most American Jews think they're not religious because they don't believe in the supreme being that they assume I believe in. And they assume our tradition is about. And they don't believe in, and they don't like going to services, worship services. A very small fraction of 1% of Jews attend any kind of worship services more than twice a year. So I hope that's not the way we define being a good Jew, because otherwise we should all be going to hell if only we had one. But we don't. So I want to say how Jews define themselves has very much been influenced in America by some of these things. But they say, I'm part of the Jewish people. So let's move away. In a moment, I'm going to move away from religion to peoplehood. But let me say, I'm going to send this out to you. What are the main characteristics of Jewish religion? I already said practice over belief. Number two, rationality over miracle. We're a highly intellectual, rational religion. There's a line I want to say, but I'll probably offend someone, so I better.
Go ahead.
Sure. Well, you know, I can say it this way. One way to see religions are, you know, someone like William James or others, that, you know, like, how do we classify religions? One way to divide religions are into ones that focus on believing in miracle, believing in something that's very hard rationally to believe in, because when you believe in that, it sets you free. You know, it's incredibly powerful. You have like a rebirth experience, a reawakening. So that you believe in something, it sounds, and people will make fun of you. They'll be like, oh, well, you believe in the Trinity. Well, how can you divide something into three and blah, blah. And people make fun, or they'll say, Jesus was a person, or he was God. He can't be both, or how can you believe that? And they'll make fun of you. But the truth is, somehow by embracing something that sounds very hard to believe, you transition into another spiritual state. Judaism is not one of those religions. Judaism is, as one kid once told me who went to both church, she went to evangelical church on Sunday morning, she came to us for Hebrew school on Wednesdays, and I asked her, I said, what's the difference? And she said, when I go to my evangelical church with my dad, they're constantly trying to get me to believe things I don't believe. And I said, well, you know, because they think it'll set you free, it'll help you. And she's like, when I come here, I'm just asked to believe things I already believe. I thought that was a very accurate 13-year-old statement, because that's really what we do. I don't say, Gigi, if only when you come, you would get rid of evolution in your brain and embrace, you know, that the dinosaurs are a fiction or something. Like, that's ridiculous. The rabbis are the creators of our religion have always embraced science, and they've always embraced questioning and rationality. In fact, I mean, if you said, you know, I don't believe that the Israelites and the prince of Egypt, that there was a miracle and the water split, I just think there was a low tide. I do too. You can totally believe there was no miracle at the sea. It was just a natural occurrence that there was a low tide. You could even say, I don't even think there was a Moses. I think it was made up later. Like I said, I mean, you can say there's no God and you can still be a good Jew, right? I mean, in the sense. So like, I'm like, okay. Most of the rabbis were incredibly rational. They were reasonable people. They didn't like the idea of interventions in the natural world, and they loved science. And so I'll give you one, and give you an example. The beginning of Genesis states that on the first day, that the world was created in 6 days. And the first thing that's created is God says, let there be light. And then on the fourth day, God says, according to the scripture, let there be the sun and the stars. Right? So the rabbis, when they're looking at this, say, wait a second. We have a contradiction here, which is that what's the light on the first day if there are no stars? Right? And there's no universe until the fourth day. So they said, from this we learn two things. Or we can learn two things. You don't have to buy it. I'll say something about that in a second, but I'll say it now, which is one of the big distinctions about our religion, is that the religion is getting you to question more than it's getting you to answer. The questions are more important than the answers. It's highly encouraging of critical thinking. So, for example, in the Talmud, they say that he who reads the Bible literally is an idiot and it's an offense against God. Because it would be saying that the Bible is just like an ordinary human thing. Like when I write my journal from yesterday, that's like God writing. It's turning it into something human rather than something magical, something amazing, something extraordinary. Each word of the Bible has thousands and thousands of meanings, all of which are intended by God. Right? But one of them may be intended for you, one of them may be intended for you, and some of them may be intended for our children's 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 children. So the important thing is to get people to like ask questions. Well, what could that word mean? And why is this happening? And what's this? And I discovered something new, or something archaeological came up. I'm like, wow. You know. And we pass on the education that I'm doing for the kids is to get them to ask critical questions and then speculate on answers. And then you live with the answers until the answers don't work. You move on, and then you make new answers. So one of the things that came up, the rabbi said, look, the most important thing is that you notice that contradiction. And you pass that contradiction onto your children, and them onto their children, and them onto their children. Now, if you want some answers, let's have some fun. And the rabbis say in the Talmud, they say, okay, let's have some fun. Does this answer work for you? Number one, the world's not created in 6 days. Because we define a day based on the movement of the sun and the planet Earth. So there is no day prior to the fourth day. And this is to teach us that a God day and a human day are very different. And that a God day could be billions of years long. And they take a quote from the Psalms where the Psalms say, human time and divine time are completely different. And I use this a lot at funerals, and that's a separate issue. But our lives are a blink in God's eye. The way time is experienced by God and by humans is totally different. And therefore, a God day can be for however long God thinks it should be. The second thing they say is, how is there any visual light? What is the light on the first day if there are no sun or stars or anything until the fourth day? And they say it's clearly not visual light. The Hebrew word or, like I said, every word's got a million meanings. Or can definitely mean just energy. It doesn't have to mean light. So they say the first thing that happened is a gigantic, all there was an infinity of light. Or an infinity of energy. And that energy, they call it, let's call it a God energy. And it's not a visual light. And whatever God energy is, it suffuses the universe, and without it, the universe wouldn't exist. That's all we're meant to learn from that. The rabbis wrote out about a third of the rabbis actually added to that their account of creation, which said that infinity wanted the secret aim of God is infinity. Infinity wanted something to be finite. That's what we call the creation of the cosmos. God, the infinity
created a special kind of energy, and it all was focused into one little point, and that point had all infinite finite dimensions cannot contain infinite energy, and it exploded. And the cosmos is what is the result of that explosion. And this is what Genesis is talking about. That was written about 1,500 years ago. It's very much like the Big Bang. So they had some pretty good speculations. They were pretty smart. So the main thing I wanted to say about that is it's about critical thinking, questioning, non-literal reading, because the word day is not a day. They ask, Eve is made from a rib of Adam. And they're like, well, what does that mean? Does that mean women are worse than men or something? And they say, well, the word tsela doesn't really mean rib. The word tsela means side. And they say that, and they really probably get this from Plato, but they say that it says that the original Adam was both masculine and feminine at the same time. That's chapter 1 of Genesis. God made the Adam masculine and feminine. So they say whatever the original organism was, it was neither male nor female. I think of it as like an amoeba. Right? And they said eventually over time, because then in chapter 2 it says this original being ended up dividing along the side. So tsela, Eve being made from a side of Adam basically means a half. So eventually there turned out to be, and then it says, and then chapter 2 says there were men and there were women. So for me, biologically, I see that as originally we came from some kind of single-celled organism in the ocean, and eventually we evolved to actually have male and female mammals, and a side is not a side. So the main idea being critical thinking, passing on of questions, and an emphasis on rationality, and on anything knowledge is knowledge. It's all good stuff. It goes into the way we read. It's not prevented from coming in. There's an emphasis on ethics over theology, as I already stated. So I won't go into that again. But the idea is, God's more important in how you behave toward other people than in the way you behave toward God. You cannot get to God by stepping on people. Complete, like, holy war, not okay. Right? You can't kill someone in the name of God in Judaism. There are places for self-defense, but the idea of a holy war is important. You can't please God by hurting someone else. There's a great focus on, in ethics, it's what we call situational ethics, not ideals. Jews have a reputation for being highly legalistic. They're always going to pick apart everything you say, everything you write, right? My brief stint as a teacher, they're always like, God, Professor Kane, you rips apart every line, too picky. So like Jews like pick apart everything, So one of the reasons is that the way we do ethics, if anybody studies Greek philosophy, the rabbis adopted Aristotle's approach over Plato's, which is that you don't just have big slogans like just be compassionate, just be loving, just be forgiving, or do unto others as you would have. Those are all very nice, and we can talk about them, but the bottom line is that the way you do ethics is you sit there and you say, okay, my kid is not doing what the teacher wants in school, and I got to go to the parent-teacher conference. How the hell am I going to handle this? And slogans like, just love your kid, or support, advocate for your child, support them. I mean, slogans won't get you anywhere. You have to actually dig deep. Maybe if you actually respect your rabbi, you make an appointment with your rabbi or your minister or your preacher or your best friend. But these things are complicated. Ethics comes from the situation. You've got to sit down. You've got to pick it apart. You've got to be like, well, you got this obligation to your kid, but you also got this obligation to the teacher. Do you have all the information you need? Like, how do you go into that meeting? And you start to pick it apart. What you got in the principal's note? Was it something about lying? Does your kid regularly lie? Does your kid have a learning disability? I mean, in other words, it all comes into play. And so Jews did end up getting very involved in the law because a lot of Jewish lawyers, because we actually grew up being trained to pick apart situations. There are lots of shades of gray. We're a very shade of... I shouldn't have said that. Okay.
God, they ruined that now, 50 Shades of Grey. We're a very 50 Shades of Grey religion. So we really are, because it's like none of us are perfect. We're not perfect parents. We're doing our best. But the more you can kind of dig into these situations, and Aristotle used to call this, and I really love it. I mean, every situation, he used to call it overdetermined. Every situation has too many good things you could do. So the problem is, which good thing do I support my kids, support my teacher, support this, support that? It's like, so situations are complicated. You got to dig into them. That's what we call situational ethics. And you can't just get a bumper sticker and say, you can't walk into every situation with the golden rule. I don't know how I do the golden rule exactly with teacher. I'm not trying to mock the golden rule. I mean, you could say, well, how would the golden rule apply in this situation with this teacher conference I'm going into? But it's only one part of the larger scheme. Because otherwise you end up being too black and white in your thinking. You think that there's a simple formula you can apply to life, and we don't believe that. So those are some of the main characteristics of the religion, and there's one other, and then I'll move on. This is actually something that most Jews don't know, so I don't know if it's going to help you unless you want to know more than the people you're helping. The tradition is very much interested in, I think I wrote it out here in a nice one-liner, individuals are accountable to individuals. If I wrong you, I got to make it up to you. I can't just go apologize to God, all right? Because I wronged you. So you are you must make amends with other. And an individual is accountable to individuals. But to God, we are communally accountable. And this is a super big deal. So for example, I'll give you the simplest example. When I go and recycle my water bottle, and it's time for me to go to heaven, whatever that means, right? Because again, it really is literally in Judaism, whatever that means. And it's time for me to go to heaven. Is God going to say, "Wait, no, Dov, you get a point. The bottle." God actually says, I say, "Hey, God, don't forget about the bottle." God says, from God's point of view, my salvation is utterly communal. If we despoiled and ruined the earth, we're accountable. So, yes, I must recycle the bottle because we are communally answerable to God as a society. But I don't get an individual point. And it's a bummer. I think that's one of the reasons that Judaism has it's got to make a comeback someday. But people are less and less religious because most people want individual comfort and individual salvation. I mean, I'm talking about Jews. I'm not like saying other people are narrow. I mean, we are. Jews like, I want to be saved. I want my life to be better. I want to get a point for everything I do. And I really don't want my rabbi to say, you get a point from your kid, but because you're good to your kid. Because the individual accountability. But from God, unfortunately, sorry to tell you this, but God, think of it this way. I know God's not up in the sky the way I think of God, but for a moment, we use those metaphors. When God looks down, God sees the entire society. God does not spend his time or her time following my Facebook page. So glad that sushi was awesome, so much better than the place in Escondido, but God has got better things to do. So God's basically, so what does the tradition say? God's looking at, where is God's attention on a society? Whether people are being hurt, particularly according to Jewish scripture, it names particular groups. God has a special interest in whether immigrants are being treated with respect, non-citizens, whether daily laborers who are not on salary, whether they're being exploited or they're actually making a living wage, animals, very great concern in the tradition for animals, particularly because animals can't defend themselves. So people who mistreat animals, it's a very bad thing because animals, they can't fight back. Children who don't have fathers. Often this is translated in the King James Bible as orphan. But an orphan in biblical Hebrew means you can still have your mom. You just don't have your dad. And so fatherless children, women who are not attached to a man. So women who have been divorced or who are widowed,
and children, because children can't defend themselves. So God basically, according to the Torah and Jewish tradition, looks at society and is basically looking at them. And I would add in nature. There are certain protections for nature. And God's like, okay, nature can't protect itself from you making it toxic. But God's not interested in giving the Dava point for recycling. God's just looking, is this a society that's just ruining the earth, where animals are mistreated? In Judaism, vegetarianism is considered the highest form of dietary laws. It's the one my wife and I keep. And, you know, do you really have to eat meat? You know, and so that that's God's focus is on whether the society is a just society. So we are individually accountable in our personal relationships to each other, and God does consider that highly important. But to God, we are accountable for a just society, particularly for whether those who are defenseless are being exploited. Okay, I was going to completely switch gears to something else that's a little easier, which is a little... is that okay? Okay. So here we go. Peoplehood. What does it mean? Things I think that you should think are important. Oh, there was one more. Oh, I already said I was going to move on. Okay, I'll come back to that. Okay, I have to do that one. I'll do it quickly. One thing, this may not come up in your work. I already said Jews read the Bible critically, with questions, free thinking. The more answers, the better. The more questions you can generate, the better. If you can, I don't know if you know the story. It's close to my heart. I forget his last name. His first name was Isidore. One of the Nobel Prize winners who was Jewish, when he gave his speech in Stockholm, he said, I credit, true story, I verified it. He said that, he was a scientist. He said, I give credit to my mom for my winning the Nobel Prize, because every day when I came home from school, she would ask me, did you have a good day, but did you ask a good question, and what was it? And that's like one of those things I live with imprinted on my brain. Not did you have a good day, but did you ask a good question, and what was it? And that defines the way we retort. Now, a large part of the Hebrew Bible is something called the prophets. Generally, Jews read the prophets very different than most Christians. Many Christians read and it's really the majority of the Hebrew Bible is that part that's called the prophets section. Amos, Hosea, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Obadiah, and all the rest of them. And they, in our opinion, are not like Nostradamus. I don't know if that means anything to anyone anymore. They are not future predictors. They are not like, if you know how to read Obadiah right, you would know that Google was a stock to pick. You know, you would have, you know, none of this is predictions for the, it's not coded predictions of the future. We don't read the prophets as coded predictions of the future. Rather, we read them as the thing I just said. The most famous definition of prophet in Jewish philosophy, it says, a prophet is someone who feels what God is feeling and puts it into words. Martin Luther King was a prophet. I mean, I think people who believe in environmental rights and things like that they feel what the whole earth is feeling, and they know how to put it into words. And does it involve the future? Kind of. It's like, we will destroy ourselves if we don't. That's not a code. I'm not coding that in the year 2065, you know, there will be a biosphere or something, and Matt Dillon will star. Matt will star in the movie or whatever. He stars in every single movie where someone's off by themselves, in the future. So, Matt Damon. So, you know, they're not predicting. They're just saying. They're feeling like, you know what? I mean, the poor are going to riot. They're like, everyone's hungry, and the rich don't give a damn. This society is going to fall. They're speaking for God's judgment of the society. And they're saying, we're going to fall. By the way, when societies fall, the innocent are punished along with the guilty in Judaism. So one of people's favorite questions is, how can you be religious if innocent suffer along with the guilty? And I'm like, because that's true in real life. Like, why should I believe something I don't really believe? Of course, if we poison the planet, of course the innocent suffer along with the guilty. Right? If we have chemicals, the pesticides that are allowed to be in strawberries or BPA or, you know, covering our kids' food, you know, like, I don't think it's only going to affect, you know, bad people. So, like, the Bible already understands that. It's saying God judges society because when cosmic consequences come, like, And if you actually read Deuteronomy and Leviticus, they say, well, there, financial collapse of the economic system. You know, I mean, this is not exactly like people will get little purple spots on their ears. I mean, it's like stuff we can all relate to. Like, the economy is going to collapse and money will be worthless. People will be so hungry, it's awful, Deuteronomy says, they'll be tempted to eat their own children. I mean, like, and it sounds horrible, but they're like, people will be really friggin' hungry. And anyone who watches these futuristic movies knows what I'm talking about. So, like, I'm saying that there's a sense which the prophets are about saying there'll be cosmic consequences for societies failing to be just, fair, because those societies will crumble. They'll destroy themselves. And the innocent will perish along with the guilty. So that's important, because I do a lot of ecumenical Bible study. But I'm trying to limit it, because whenever I go over to, like, my friend at the Baptist church and I do Bible study with him, I'm always fighting with him, because he's always like, come on, Nadav, come on. Tell me what the code is on Isaiah 26:3. And I'm like, there's no code, Pastor. There's no code. You know, and he's like, I know there's the secret code. You know, like, you got to tell me what the secret code is on that one. And, you know, and I'm like, yeah, it's not... We can make a good question about Isaiah 26:3, but no, I don't have the secret prediction for you to help you with your stock picks. So that was what I needed to say about the prophets. So, okay, to peoplehood. So, you know, Jews are touchy, right? We're very sensitive about our history of persecution. And let me tell you a little bit about what it's like. So not only did our country get destroyed a few times along the way between 1000 BC and 70 AD, but after that, basically for 2,000 years, and most Jews don't realize this, for 2,000 years, Jews were not allowed to be citizens in the countries in which they lived. Think about this. I'll give you the end part is this. Basically, the first place, except for a few here and a few there, a couple in Amsterdam and stuff, but we're talking about just a curiosity, 1776. It was the first time Jews were allowed to be citizens of the countries they lived in, and it was in America. The only problem is there were almost no Jews here. So, like, it was great. It was kind. Love America. It just affected about 15,000 people. 1789, France followed suit and allowed Jews to become citizens. Also, didn't affect a lot, and it was important historically. But then Germany in the mid-1800s, that was the biggest effect on Jewish history, where Germany finally allowed things like Jewish kids to go to public school. Brand new, except for France and America, for a few Jews. So scholars compare us to the Gypsies in Romania or to the Kurds in Iraq, where it's like, we're just this weird ethnic population that has no rights. You have no rights. Can't go to school. You can't hold any public job. I'm not just talking mayor, policeman, fireman, mailman, nothing. No one who gets a public check can be a Jew. Can't participate in public service in any way. Military, can't serve in the military, right? Can't join the army. Can't be a teacher, can't be a doctor, can't do any of this stuff. For 2,000 years, it's pretty bad. Can't have freedom of travel, right? You need special permission from local authorities if you just want to go from one place to another. Certainly can't live where you want to live. We're basically limited to certain villages and to certain ghettos within urban areas. The reason this is really important is that it led to some real... As a Jew, it's crazy to us that then we were blamed for that. So what happens is that when Jews are finally really in the 1800s, look, in Eastern Europe, like Poland and Russia, Jews only got citizenship in the early 20th century. I mean, you're talking about 100 years ago. My relatives grew up in Russia, their passport said Jew on it. It did not say Russian. So when they went to things like it's financial aid, you couldn't go to university, right? When you actually had to enroll at the registrar, you had to show your papers. And if it said Jew, you weren't a Russian. You're good to go. So Jews were basically not allowed to have any professions. They were limited to two professions in Europe. One was peasant, right? You can clean my toilets. You can pick my apples. You know, you can shoe my horse. You can be a peasant in a village. You can cut down trees for me, and maybe I'll buy your wood. Or two, you could open a business. No one's preventing you. I mean, you have to pay off the authorities for your business licenses and stuff, but no one's preventing you from opening a store.
Jews largely became merchants. And money is not a dirty thing in Judaism. Money can serve God. Because we have a lot of tithing and stuff. So, like, I mean, you have to share your money. So, like, money is not inherently a dirty thing. But basically, Jews had a choice of being a peasant or opening up a business. They opened up a lot of businesses. I lived in Indonesia for years. In Indonesia, it's the fourth largest country in the world. Money is considered a dirty business to be involved in. And so the Chinese run a lot of the businesses. And they're hated for it. You know, and I'll be with my Indonesian friends, and they make all these anti-Chinese remarks, like those dirty Chinese. I'm like, you go and open a business. I mean, why don't you open a shoe store? You know what I mean? I mean, I need some shoes. I got to go. You know what I mean? I'll buy from you. And they're like, oh, business. So, like, the Jews were actually blamed for doing the only thing they were allowed to do. And they were accused. And then there was another thing they did. Hopefully you know this one. Some Jews were allowed to go into banking. And the reason was that under Catholic Church in medieval Europe, Catholics were under the stricter popes. Catholics were not allowed to charge interest on loans to other Catholics, not even 1%. So Catholics largely didn't lend money because, if I'm a rich Catholic, I'd rather buy some land and grow something and sell it than lend it to you and you maybe pay it back in 20 years with no interest at all. So, like, that's not great for me. So Jews were used in the banking industry. They were good with numbers. They're highly literate. And some Jewish families became very important in the banking industry. So this is what Jews were limited to. And then they were blamed for it. So they were blamed for being money-oriented. They were blamed that there's a conspiracy, that the Jews run the banking. And if you think these things, because they didn't serve in the military, they were accused of being unpatriotic. Not only that, they were then accused of being by nature traitors. This actually came up famously because after Jews were accepted as citizens in France in 1789, a short time later, a famous Jewish officer was convicted of treason for no reason. His name was Dreyfus. It's a very famous case in history because basically it's like, he's a Jew, he's a traitor. I mean, the fact that we now allowed him in the military doesn't change the fact that Jews are by nature traitors because we didn't used to let them serve in the military. They always have divided loyalties. Hitler used this. Hitler, when he was kind of in the Donald Trump stage of his ascendancy, when he was doing that, when he was like starting his rallies and he was running for Congress. He won, by the way, and when he was a minor congressman, he burned down the entire Congress and then blamed it on the Jews and the communists and declared himself the Führer. So that came a little later. But when he was running, his running platform is that the Jews lost, like, the Jews are the reason that Germany lost World War I. And you're like, how could anyone believe that? They didn't, at that point, Jews were allowed to serve in the military because of 1850. Remember I said in Germany, it was in the mid-1800s, they were finally allowed to gain citizenship, serve in the army, and go to public school, go to university. And it's their fault. Once they joined the army, look what happened to it. They probably had secret financial dealings that they benefited from us losing, and people bought it. So, like, this is where we're very touchy about these financial and conspiracy stereotypes, and I want you to understand the history of where they came from. Now, I'm going to get on topic, and I'm going to talk a second about Israel. And you could say, well, America is great. In America, they didn't hate Jews, right? Except for the fact that just around the time Hitler was rising to power, there was a lot of anti-Semitism in this country. Most Jews who came to this country came in the wave of immigration mostly around the year 1900. They came between 1880 and 1920, but mostly around the year 1900, and they came over because they were being massacred in Eastern Europe. In Poland, remember, when I said we weren't citizens in, like, Russia and Poland, you were not entitled to police protection. Oh, no, for real. Let's say you were a Jew and you had a store. My grandfather had a little clothing store. He called it a department store, and it was smaller than this classroom. I was like, why is this a department store, Saba, which is the Hebrew for grandpa? And he'd be like, well, here's my shoe section over in this corner. And he used to tell me, you know, he's like, I'd like try on a pair of sneakers. I'm like, I think they're too small. And he's like, we have the special shoe machine that fixes all shoes. And he'd go behind a curtain, there was a broom. And he would push that shoe, because he didn't have the other size.
And he'd stretch that thing out on the broom, be like, it was on the special machine, it's now a 9.5. So so you had your little Jewish department store and you're eking out a living.
So if you lived in Russia, Eastern Europe, Poland, all these countries, Romania, Hungary, you had no police protection. So if someone decided, the teenagers decided to break your windows, right? Riot, steal your stuff. The only reason the local sheriff would do anything about it is only if they liked you. Like, it was up to them. It was totally in their discretion. And they could be like, oh, Nadav. Like, oh, yeah, you know, I'm not one of those Jew haters. And you seem like a nice guy. Okay, okay, okay. I'll go talk to the boys' fathers and tell them, keep the boys in line. Or it could be like, dirty Jew, I'm not going to do anything about it. You had no right to police protection. So that what happened to you just happened to you. And I think we understand. Why am I talking about this in terms of Jewish as an ethnicity? Right? It's not so different than being African-American before the Civil Rights Movement. It's like, what are you entitled to and what you're not entitled to? And not really clear. And sheriffs just turning their back on you, you know, and things, and allowing things to happen to you. So that we were defined as an ethnicity, as kind of like a people. And in America in 1924, the United States passed the Immigration Reform Act. And it said, only a few thousand Jews will be allowed into this country each year from now on because they are mentally retarded and they are incapable of becoming good American citizens. When I hear today people talk about Mexicans and stuff, be like, they won't even learn English. They speak Spanish. My relatives all spoke Yiddish, right? English is hard to learn, you know, and I'm always like, since when does any immigrant group like not speak its own language at home? You know what I mean? Like, what's weird about that? But in any case, they don't learn English. They're stupid, they don't take direction, they don't know what it means to be American, and we cut off all immigration to this country. Now, one of the things that happened there was that, what happened 10 years later? The Holocaust. So as Hitler rose to power and riots started happening and Jewish things started happening, one of the things that happened is that Jews started fleeing to come to America, getting on boats, getting and trying to make it to America. They were turned away by pretty much every country on earth. And there are famous stories of their movies and so on, or stories of their ships called like the Exodus and things like that, of Jews escaping murder, where America turned back the boats and sent them back to Germany, where people were killed in the ovens. And it even affected after the Holocaust. So finally, World War II ends. And there's still a couple hundred thousand Jews who were not killed, who are now 70, you know, friends of mine. The synagogue, you know, men who are down to 70 pounds, skin and bones, and they're freed by American soldiers and also some Russian soldiers in concentration camps by the Red Cross comes in, and there's no place for them to go. There wasn't a single country on earth that really took Holocaust survivors after the Holocaust. They didn't know where to go. So they got on boats and went to this area that is called Israel today, and it was it was a territory controlled by Britain. And they started buying land from Arabs who lived there. And so there were Jewish villages and there were Arab villages in Israel. And Holocaust survivors were getting on boats that were being bought by charity organizations and others, trying to bring people over. And the Arabs there were concerned that this Jewish population would get too large. Fighting broke out, and the British decided to leave. So the British decided, this is way too much trouble than it's worth, and we're gonna leave. And they did. While they were leaving, the UN sent a commission to study the problem. And when they were there, boats coming from concentration camps in Europe were shot at by the British and forced to go back to Europe. And even though these were not Jews from the UN, they were like, this is horrible. You have Holocaust survivors and no place to go. That's when the UN came up with a plan. The committee went back to the UN and recommended that this area be partitioned into a left side and a right side, and a left side be called Israel, and a right side be called Palestine, and that the land is divided into two states. The Arab countries rejected that plan. America had a very interesting thing. The Poles in America were very much against supporting the plan because Americans didn't want to get involved in some new conflict right after World War II ended. And they were afraid there was going to be a war and then it would be a mess and we didn't want to be involved.
So Truman went on television, basically, and he said that the Congress is against this, my cabinet's against it, the American people are against supporting this UN resolution of two states over there, and I'm going to instruct the American representative to vote in favor of it. Because I actually visited the concentration camps myself, and I saw men, women, and children dying of starvation and how they'd be treated, and if no country is going to take them in, then we need to at least vote for this plan. Because we're still not taking them in, because still on the books in America, Jews are retarded and can't become American. So the reason I say all that is that Jews are very touchy about the topic of Israel. And no one's allowed to claim that they have all the facts on the history of the Palestinians and the Israelis, and I'm not here to tell you I know better than you about history. I'm trying to tell you why it is that Jews are so touchy about Israel is partly about the fact that we are a people who, even up to very recently, were constantly basically allowed to die, even by America. And Israel was this homeland for people to go. So Jews are very emotional about the idea that it should be taken away or that it is evil. The plight of Arabs and Palestinians in Israel is terrible. And Jews like me fight with other Jews over this issue. We all know that the Arab countries attacked Israel after the UN resolution passed in 1948. There was a war in 1968, all the Arab countries attacked again, and in 1973, all the Arab countries surrounding Israel attacked again with the single idea of massacring every Jew and killing them. And in that process, there are about 20% of the Israeli population is Arab, because there have been Arabs living there all the way through. And they're citizens, and they have parties in the government and political leaders and all that. But many of the Arabs live in the area that was supposed to be, what we call the West Bank, was supposed to be a Palestinian state, according to the UN resolution, and never became one. And the plight of the people who live in that area is abominable, which is they're in this ridiculous limbo. I mean, it's enough to be in limbo for 2 years. To be in limbo for 60 or 70 years, it's unconscionable. I think that most Jews who are willing to go there know that. The question is the blame game. Jews get sensitive about the blame game, which is it Israel's fault? We were attacked 3 times. Is it Israel's fault? Arab countries haven't helped those Arabs more. Is it Israel's fault? I mean, blah, blah, blah. So, like, we're touchy and defensive about the issue of Israel. I hope that with the people you work with, it's not rooted in a racism against Arabs or a sense in which any non-Jew, you know, they're Jews who say terrible things. You know, they'll be like, well, they had it coming because they didn't vote in favor of the resolution in 1948. Or they had it coming because they attacked us 3 times. And I'm like, you know what? That's ridiculous. I mean, because in a sense, what you have is, you know, your average Palestinian 16-year-old, he did not attack us in 1968. He wasn't even born. You know, so like, but I wanted you to understand, I mean, my goal on a sensitive issue was to have you understand that the sensitivity isn't so much about the actual details of what happened recently. It's about the fact that, like, why are we always blamed? I mean, does anybody understand? And the worst thing about it is this, in my opinion, which is that I feel like the whole Israel thing is defined as who's a bigger victim? Were the Palestinians a bigger victim or are Jews a bigger victim? And as a rabbi, I'll tell you, I don't think victim mentalities are very helpful. I mean, I don't think that they're the way to change your life is to see yourself as a victim. And I think that when you have two groups whose main debate is who's a bigger victim, I'm like, why the hell are we having that debate? I'd rather fix things and solve them. But that is the sensitivity that I wanted you to understand about we are people who are persecuted. You know, we don't have a rosy history, even in America, and that Israel is doing its best, and the plight of Palestinian people is very sad, but please don't, to call Israel some great aggressor feels racist to us, because it feels like it feels like we're kind of being picked on again. Like when we had no power, we were picked on. Then we actually had a little state, which is like the size of Delaware. And it's like, oh, now you're big-ass aggressor, terrible tyrant. And I'm like, we're like that big. You know what I mean? And you know, and I'm like, so it feels weird to us. It feels like it does have a racist dimension to it, especially in college demonstrations and things like that, against us, even though I know that the vast majority, if not the vast majority, of students who demonstrate on campuses against Israel, I know they think they're doing the right thing. Like, I know they don't see it as a racist act. They don't see them as, I hate Jews. I know they don't see it that way. They see it as like, you know, I read a pamphlet about Palestinians who have to grow up in occupied territory where they don't have their own country, and I think it's terrible. And so, like, I totally know that it's not that. But it's hard for a Jew to see that. Because the Jew sees it as, yet again, Jews are to blame, right? Can't be in the military. Oh, we're traitors now, right? Because, I mean, you know, oh, all we care about is money. We couldn't do anything but have things about money. So I know my time's wrapping up, but it's that. That's the context you have to understand. Is it's felt as racism, just as much as, well, I'll leave it at that. So there are a couple, I'm going to send you out some things, but I'm going to cover, and I know it's your thing. So we're ending in very shortly, right?
We have 7 minutes.
Oh, okay. A couple of quickies that you might run into that are probably more the things that I was supposed to talk about. I want to talk about some of the big Jewish holidays and things you're going to run into. In September, you have two holidays, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. I'm going to send them out to you. They're the two times a Jew should go to synagogue, even if they don't like worship services. Because it's the time we stand before God together and we say, our society could be more just and we could be doing a better job. Many Jews today choose, when I grew up, we all stayed out of public school. And now most of the people in my congregation send their kids to school because they say, Rabbi, my kids will be an academic disadvantage if they don't miss school 2 days a year. And I'm like, are you kidding me? So I would ask that any future teachers really, like, maybe proactively, because ask their kid, you know, is anyone going to miss Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur in September? And if so, we can make up that work. I can help you with it. Like, it would go a long way to just, because I'm telling you, parents don't even ask anymore. They're like, I'm not going to ask Mrs. Ferguson. You know what I mean? My kid can't miss. And so that's one thing. Hanukkah and Christmas come up. Hanukkah is a celebration of the human right to freedom of religion, which was the main cause of a war that happened in 186 BC. And it's a very sensitive time for people like me and others in public schools where I have my kids and where I grew up, because my wife is in education. Most public schools don't understand the Supreme Court's position on this, which is actually really clear. And people like me don't understand it. In the Constitution, the Supreme Court has upheld. What it says is that a public institution like a school can't respect one religion over another, can't respect one institution of religion more than another. Today, most teachers take this as we can have a holiday concert, a winter concert of 10 Christmas carols and a Jewish song, and then maybe some other song. And we have represented everybody. Supreme Court has said that's not true. Because by having 8 of one and 1 or 2 of another, you have shown a respect for one over another. So most people are not aware that proportionality is actually illegal. If you say, well, I have, you know, 3 Jewish students, so we do 7 days on Christmas and 1 day where I read a Hanukkah story in my class, like my kid's elementary school teacher does. And she's a fantastic teacher, but she thinks it's okay. We did a Hanukkah book. And I know that she thinks that's amazing. But for me, it is a slap in the face, because the Supreme Court said, you're sending a child an image that we do 7 of this and 1 of that. It's exactly what the Supreme Court says you're not allowed to do. You could do 1. And by the way, you don't have to cover every religion, by the way. The Supreme Court says, well, what if you do 1 Christmas, 1 Hanukkah? I know no one does Kwanzaa anymore. 1 Kwanzaa, but you've got a Hindu student. You do anything on Hinduism? The Supreme Court says, well, that may not be a good idea pedagogically, but it's legal, because it's not that you respected one of the ones you did over one of the other ones you did. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do every one, but you can't prefer one over another. So I wanted to make you aware of that, because people like me feel discriminated against because we feel like the teacher is bragging that they read a Jewish book, and my feeling is like, and my kids singing Jingle Bells a million times. So the other thing I want to say about Christmas and Hanukkah is that I know that a lot of people think that Santa is not religious, and Christmas trees are not religious, and Jingle Bells is not religious. But because Jews don't see themselves as primarily about, religion is not defined for us as belief in God and miracles and certain things in Scripture. It's defined as peoplehood and culture. There's no difference to me about Jesus and Santa Claus. Because the way I understand my religion is that it's basically as an ethnicity. You know, like it's a people I come from with the history and cultural practices. So my kids singing Jingle Bells 100 times, that is Christmas to me. And I mean, it is her favorite song because I do send her to public school. So one thing I just ask is that you are welcome to have your own views on it, but I just want you to know that from where I come from, like that's a tough one. Like I don't that's not my model. But I'm not saying that teachers who see it that way are not, again, doing their best and actually trying to be really awesome teachers. But from a Jewish perspective, that does feel a little weird. So, and that's my entire presentation.
Wait. Your wife wants you to talk about...
You're right. Okay, the last thing she wanted to talk about is she wanted me to mention sin and shame. And this actually may affect social workers, I don't know. One of the big theological differences that of the Talmud and the Catholic Church was over sin. Do Jews believe in original sin, and what's the nature of sin? In the early Catholic Church, and early Catholic theology... there was a sense in which sex is like a dirty... The body is the vehicle for sin. Appetites of hunger, appetites of sex, being hormonal, these things are the devil's playground. Judaism doesn't view it that way. So the Talmud took a very opposite position, consciously, they knew Christians very well, was that the body is a beautiful thing. Sex is a beautiful thing. Like I said, the whole reason on Friday night we're supposed to sit around light, you know, we have candlelight, we drink wine and have a good meal, and then you can't go out and accept any social invitations, is the Talmud's all about, like, spend the night having sex. Can't go to work on Saturday. You're supposed to only have sex with a spouse, but there's an openness to having sex with a loved one within the tradition, because in the Bible there doesn't seem to be marriage per se, exactly as we understand it. But in any sense, that she wanted me to say that, like, she found... My wife's a convert, by the way. So she converted to Judaism. She's like, one of the things that amazed her about it was they don't have the same kind of shame issues around things like drinking. We believe in moderation. The rabbis were all about moderation. They said, if you're drinking red wine on a Tuesday night, you should look in the mirror and get some help. But if you're drinking Friday night or on a holiday, it's a festival. Be festive. So things like intoxication... You know, on holidays is accepted, intoxication on a work day is not. But she just really once said, like, when you talk, like, that we don't necessarily preach abstinence. I mean, like, we're much more, we understand that the body can be a vehicle for love and good and not for shaming. And so that's something that's been very important. By the way, just the final thing about conversion in general, and I put it in the notes I'll send out to you, is that converting to Judaism is not having a religious reawakening. It's actually deciding to join a tribe. So it's making we have lots of families in my congregation, for example, where someone didn't convert, you know, two people get married, the interfaith couple, and they have kids. My answer is, look, when you come to my place, like my synagogue, you're on the reservation, right? We're like Native American reservation or something. We're the Jewish reservation. We do things Jewish ways. We tell our ancestors stories in the Jewish way. We preach, we tell Jewish stories. And you're welcome to be here and participate. There's no problem with that. If you ever want to say, I want to go through the official initiation rite, you know, I kind of want to go to the sweat lodge, I kind of want to become an official member of this tribe, then we have a conversion process where you learn a few things and you raise your right hand, you cross your heart, and you say, I want to be a Jew, and you dip in water, and you have a Jewish baptism, and then you get to be a Jew. But you don't have to be like, the heavens opened up, I realized the one true God. It's not necessarily a religious conversion. It's a decision to actually join a persecuted people. So you're joining the tribe and you make it official. So that some people, I think, when it comes to conversion, they're like, oh, like, why did you convert? Did you suddenly realize the Old Testament was the way? And people are like, what are you talking about? The rabbi asked me if I wanted to join the reservation. You know, so that's kind of where it is.
Wow.
That's, I know, wow. It's a lot. Wow. I hope I didn't offend any of you.
probably good.